Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
We're in our new podcast room. Mm-hmm. So exciting.
Super sealed.
It smells of sealant.
Sealant.
What's it called? Decorator's cork.
A man came around with a gun full of it just a few minutes ago and we were thinking we might not get in. But it's better than the old one because it's not a basement anymore.
It is.
Doesn't mean the quality of the podcast is going to improve.
I think it does.
Do you think?
I think that's guaranteed.
Have you noticed that so far?
By 50%. I just purely by the sort of low level of fumes I'm getting from that sealant.
And we've also now got 60,000 listeners instead of like 2,000. Not really. It's not true. It's not true. I can't claim that. It's not true.
But it's very nice. This week has mainly been characterised by not watching Love Island. Mm-hmm. As was last week. Mm-hmm. We're both, as is so often the case in this job, you find yourself editing a lot of copy about things that you have absolutely no first-hand experience.
It does give you enough awareness of them to have the odd line of conversation with somebody, doesn't it? If you are stuck at someone's party and you can rehash one of Rachel Cook's opinions.
You can retell, sorry, Rachel, you can just retell one of her jokes. Actually, she's very funny on that in that scene this week. What are your plans for the weekend, Kate?
I'm going to see Jeff Beck tomorrow. Ah. So I have a recurring dad date, which is we go and see Jeff Beck together when he plays in London. He's now 72 or 73. And tomorrow's gig is very special because he's playing with the Chelsea Pensioners. Well, not with the Chelsea Pensioners.
That would be amazing.
He's playing at
charity
Chelsea,
single.
Chelsea Hospital, and the pensioners will be in the audience. So it should be interesting. It's all outdoors. And we were thinking, are we going to have to be standing all night? Is it one of these kind of like, you know, standy outdoor things? And of course we realised, of course it's not, because the pensioners are going to be there. It's not going to make them stand. So it should be, I'm thinking it's going to be maybe his more popular classics kind of repertoire. So he does amazing versions of Beck's Bolero. And
what's his early, like, really famous? Is it Hi-Ho Silver Lining?
That's his, he wouldn't do that.
Does he ever play that?
That's the one that, there's the song that he likened to having a pink toilet seat hung around your neck for the rest of your life. And he actually plays sort of beautiful, leisurely versions of things like Day in the Life by the Beatles. And he's just totally absorbed in his own world and he's very strange. So
I've actually seen him with my dad.
Have you?
Yeah.
Where did you see him?
At the Royal Festival Hall with Jack White. Of
wow.
The White Stripes.
Really?
Yeah.
They also played the Chelsea Pensioners.
Did they?
The White Stripes, yeah.
I have to say that was amazing because you could see that Jack White was getting to play. I mean, the White Stripes were big at this stage. They weren't necessarily the kind of mega group that they are now, or he wasn't the mega star that he is now. But you could see he was getting to play with one of his absolute heroes.
What was Beck like? Did you like him?
Yeah, I liked him. Yeah, yeah. I can't really remember him as a persona much.
He's got very wiry, sinewy arms, and he kind of wears like boxing trousers and boxing boots, and got the sort of feather haircut. He was famously the model for Nigel Tufnell and Spider-Man.
Right, yeah.
But he's still very active in that he put his bottleneck down on the stage last time I saw him, and he just swooped down in one movement and got it up while still playing. I was thinking, you're 71 at that point.
Yeah.
How did you do that? Should be good.
Jeff Beck news over. What else are we going to be talking about on this podcast?
We're going to be talking about the new exhibition, Frida Kahlo exhibition at the V&A, Making Herself Up, which is a vast collection of personal effects and a little bit of artwork. And we're going to be talking about Atlanta, which is Donald Glover's TV series now in its third season.
Third season is next year, I think.
Oh, but so
it's
this
had two seasons, yeah, aka Childish Gambino, mm-hmm. of course.
And we will have the millionth in our non-anniversary series.
So, Kate, this week we've been to see the V&A's big new exhibition, Frida Kahlo Making Herself Up, which is billed as an exhibition of artifacts showing how Kahlo fashioned her identity.
It wasn't until 1977 that one of her paintings was first sold in auction, which is amazing, for $19,000. And
so that's more than 20 years after she died.
After her death. So it wasn't, you know, in her lifetime, she wasn't sort of appreciated as the artist that she was. And it was really, weirdly enough, it was the 1990s, especially with the interest from Madonna, who started collecting her, that she became the figure that she is today. But even now, her paintings don't go for a humongous amount. Like last year, one was sold for $8 million, which in the scheme of things is not, it's not that big. But I thought that was interesting in 1977 until one was actually sold at auction.
So in her lifetime then, because this is one thing you didn't get a huge sense of from the exhibition, but in her lifetime, not really.
In her lifetime, it was her marriage to Diego Rivera, that he was the, you know, the successful commercial artist. And there is something that comes across of a slight reversal in this exhibition, because the other thing that was known about him was that he was a serial shagger and was having loads of affairs. And as this exhibition makes clear, she was also having plenty of affairs. So the whole sort of the power balance is sort of reversed, which is quite refreshing.
There's a lovely sort of recurring joke in the captions, where it's like, because as well as the artifacts, there's quite a lot of photographs in this show. And what you come to realise is that, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but the house that they lived together in Mexico became a sort of cultural meeting place, a hub. So lots of writers, artists, photographers came and took lots of pictures of the house, but also mainly of Frida Kahlo. And basically every caption is like, Edward Weston, with whom she had a brief affair, or Nicholas Murray, with whom she had a long affair.
Yeah. And Diego's sitting there in all the same pictures, yeah, grinning with his arm around her. She also had an affair with Trotsky.
Yeah.
Which was news to me.
Yeah.
I used to love Trotsky when I was at school. I thought he was quite cute, so I understand that, really.
There's a nice bit of footage of Trotsky, and he's got something, hasn't he?
He really
has.
He's
got a real charisma about him.
It's a little goatee beard as well, and the little glasses, and the sort of the intellectual student look. It sort of, it works. You can see why she did it.
So the exhibition does sort of start at the beginning of Frida Kahlo's life. And one of the interesting things you pick up quite early on is how important her dad was, really. He was German and emigrated to Mexico. And his real name was Carl Wilhelm Kahlo. And when he sort of discovered his Mexicanness, he changed it to Guillermo, which is really interesting, because she did the opposite, in that her real name was Magdalena Carmen Frida Kahlo, very Mexican, but she actually took the German bit, Frida, as her first name.
And at the height of the Roaring Twenties, that's when she decided to go into full Mexican costume forever.
So the two of them are kind of like interchanging these, you know, fluid identities, but no, they are. They're thinking about, you know, who they want to.
He's also the guy who did the self portraits first, right? So he did lots of photographs of himself in. I think it's the funny description of it. He did nude self portraits, comic self portraits, and pensive self portraits. There weren't any examples of all those three things combined in one portrait, which I would like to have seen. But it's from, you can see how from him she gets her sort of direct, defiant gaze. Like there's something in the eyes about, you know, even those are photographs and her self-portraits were paintings. It's you can see the father's daughter in there.
Yeah, he was a professional photographer, so this wasn't just a hobby, but and clearly quite a successful one. But there are a couple of sort of key life events. She has polio. She contracts polio age 6, which leaves one leg shorter than the other, and delays her entrance to school. So she spends lots of time with her dad, helping with photos. He takes pictures of her. She starts thinking about that process. And then aged 18, I think, she has this horrific accident, which she doesn't really seem to discuss or depict in directly in any great way, apart from there's one little drawing which is reproduced in a kind of offhand way in the exhibition, actually, where she kind of lays out what happened in the crash. So that she was in a wooden school bus coming back from school, which collided with a streetcar. Several people died, and she had an iron bar basically that went through her whole body, it sounds like.
There's a description of the crash that she made later in life, which was very eerie. She said something along the lines of, it was very quiet and very slow and almost very calm. It's not like you would imagine an impact to be, and the surreality of that moment, and probably realizing as well that you've been injured but not feeling it yet, because those kind of injuries you can't feel straight away because of the shock. So, and there was a mention very early on of the fact that after the polio, she created at the age of six an alternative version of herself. And
an imaginary friend.
An imaginary friend, a second Frida.
Yeah.
So that was there even before the bus crash and before adult life and painting began and everything. So that seed of looking at yourself from the outside was obviously there from the very start, which I thought was interesting.
And then that accident is kind of a really formative experience, as it would be, and feeds into so much of this show, from the fact that, yes, she starts painting around that time. She fixes up sort of mirrors to her bedpost so that she can do self-portraits while she's lying in bed. In fact, much later, because this obviously created physical problems that went throughout her whole life, there's a photograph of her in traction with kind of contraption set up so that she can paint lying
down. She's painting on a canvas directly above her head, holding her arm up straight, which is, I had no idea that she had to go through that sort of, I mean, she painted often in a wheelchair as well. So she was sitting when she was painting. I thought the title of the exhibition was strange, because in a sense, making herself up, and obviously it's punning on the fact that there's an awful lot of personal effects and paraphernalia and her relationship with her physical image, as opposed to just with her painting. But I also thought that there was something slightly diminishing about the title, because in a way, if you're kind of born a force of nature, which she obviously was, and the way that she was able to deal with this accident and to kind of take it on and make it into a creative thing, it sort of felt really, making yourself up sort of implies maybe a little bit of a lack of agency, sort of like, what am I going to do? Okay, well, I'll create this character that works. I'll create this figure in the paintings, which you also get with the sense of her sort of attention to her physical appearance and things like that. So I was kind of surprised by the title a little bit.
Yeah, especially when you see very early on, she's got such a strong personality that comes through in those photographs. There's a great family portrait quite early on, and she's wearing a suit.
Yeah.
As a young girl, they think it might have been her dad's suit. But
she's 14 and she's dressed as a man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. And there's a slight kind of knee-jerk resistance to the idea of it as well, in that you think, well, this is, you know, is there something a bit dodgy about couching a female artist in this terms? You know, why aren't we just looking at the art, and why aren't we paying more for the art?
Well, there's not much art, is there?
But there's not much art. And I think what justifies it really is that she did think a lot about images of herself. And, you know, there's one little painting, sketchy painting, which I thought was really, really interesting in terms of the thinking behind the show. She just titled it "Appearances Can Be Deceiving." And she's wearing this, there's lots in the show about Mexican traditional dress that she adopted. There's this style called Tijuana, which is South Mexican. It's a very kind of matriarchal society. She really identified with it. She liked to wear their clothes. So it's a picture of her wearing this big Tijuana dress. But it's sort of, it's got this translucent, transparent quality. So you see the dress, but then underneath it, you see everything that's damaged about her body. So you see this kind of crumbling spinal column, you see the medical corset, you see the limbs, and she's thinking about how everything that she puts on disguises all the stuff that's going on inside.
It has been criticised as a kind of shrine to pain, the exhibition. Right. So when you, it's a strange process going through, because it's partly the layout of those rooms at the V&A. You've got a very narrow corridor. You've got lots of ancient family photos and sort of historical context. And then towards the end, you come across a vast room, which is called Sickness. And this is really the kind of the place. This is what people have come to see if they know anything about this show. You've got her orthopedic legs. You've got her plaster cast that she had around her torso. You've got the contents of her medicine cabinet. You've got letters from her doctors. You've got the lipstick she wore and the prescriptions that she got her dentist to write out for extra pain relief to help her sleep at night and stuff.
And her eyebrow pencil, very important.
Her eyebrow pencil, because this, yeah,
because
in terms
of her monobrow or unibrow. We're
unibrow,
not sure. Monobrow or unibrow.
And which she, of course, accentuated. Yeah. So it wasn't as extreme as, you know. But it's a funny feeling you get from it, because in the one sense, it's sort of, it's putting too much emphasis on the physical traumas that she went through. At the same time, you almost sort of need that at the start of the exhibition in order to understand what the exhibition is trying to say. So you've got a very sort of almost ghoulish sense of the relationships that she had with her medical staff. Like there's a doctor who sent her sheet music and songs, and the dentist that she asked for sort of extra prescriptions. It's a rather dramatic explanation of how he didn't want to prescribe her any more painkillers, so he tore up his prescription book so that he couldn't prescribe her with any more and stuff. And you think she must have had such a close network of people sort of living this painful life with her all the way through. But you wonder as well whether it is actually, whether that's what the exhibition is about rather than the artwork, because there's so little of the painting there.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that, you know, she did take this stuff and turn it into art. So very literally, in the case of these, you see these medical corsets, but then she also had these plaster cast corsets that would just sit on her body. I mean, I can't really imagine what that must have been like, to be encased in plaster for huge periods of time. But she turned those into pieces of art.
And while she was wearing them.
So you see her painting on her... You know, it's a kind of, it's, you know, when you break your arm in secondary school and someone draws a cock and balls on it. You know,
exactly, that's what I was thinking. And apparently she had to be hung upside down in those casts.
Oh, my God.
And for hours in order for them to set. I mean, it does tie in very much with the, it explains the self-portraiture, because, you know, that she is in most of her paintings and you've got herself as the artwork and creation, the defiance, the almost kind of split personality that she had to develop as the sick person versus the vibrant, beautiful one that everyone wanted to kind of be near in society. And so I think it, in a way it did actually allow me to understand a lot more about her appeal as an artist, but at the same time it was like, I don't know, it was weird because you wonder what she'd think of it. You know, she could go around there and see her orthopedic leg with its fashionable boot attached to the bottom. Does she really want that to be on display,
which she never really got to wear, because that was, you know, to add to everything else, she had her leg amputated because she had gangrene,
which led to her death.
Then she died a few months after, so I think that prosthetic leg, which is really a striking object, but I doubt she would have had much use out of it.
Well, we should say as well, this stuff was locked up.
This is a key fact.
That's a key fact.
In the start of this exhibition, we're leaving key facts right to the end. Sorry, yeah, go on.
So, this stuff was locked up in a bathroom in her house.
Yeah.
I can't believe this, for 50 years? So this was unlocked by Rivera? Was he still around at that point?
No. So she died in 54.
Mm.
She left... and then Rivera died in 57, I think. But he said, all this stuff is sealed up in this bathroom. And he said, it's not to be touched for 15 years, 15
right.
years.
Yeah.
But then nowhere can I find an explanation as to why they left it till 2004 to unseal it. But I genuinely don't know. I think the house is now some sort of museum. But they didn't open it till 2004.
It's interesting because they also didn't... hide it. I mean, they did hide it, but they didn't destroy it.
No,
so they must have been imagining at some point that this stuff would be of interest. Or
I think part of it was there was some political content to some of those that maybe he thought could cause problems. But really, actually, you know, there's a lot of clothes. We haven't really talked about the clothes. Sort of, you know, in a way, after the medical stuff, it's a bit of it's a bit of a change of tone. The last room is a huge cabinet with I don't know, maybe 20 outfits kind of in the center. And they are amazing.
All traditional Mexican, yeah. A couple of Chinese skirts as well. I saw beautifully vibrant, heavily bustled Mexican clothing that you see her wearing in her own painting. So exactly what the stuff that you'd associate with her. I wonder if she had any ordinary clothes as well, any tracksuit bottoms that they didn't.
It doesn't seem so, does it? I mean, she literally, you know, I liked, there were a couple of little mentions of when she was in the States and she went there quite a lot. She basically stopped traffic. You know, she had children asking like where the circus was, you know. People were just kind of amazed to see someone dressed like this. But you get the sense that she sort of leaned into that and embraced it.
I felt that it was quite a very modern show in the sense it was a bit of the way we might look at a modern pop star. So we appreciate their appeal as sort of role models or personalities now through their struggles with depression and anxiety and their sort of private pain and things, and all that stuff is turned out for everybody to see. The cupboards are turned out, they Instagram it themselves, all this kind of thing, and in a sense that's sort of what they're doing with her. They're looking at the sort of the cult of, you know, the Freedolatry, and they're examining why it was that she's such a strong, still such an inspirational figure. I mean, I think on a very personal level, to see somebody accentuating their own facial hair and joining up their brows in the 1930s, 40s and 50s is a remarkable thing now, you know.
I mean, I think probably she is an icon now mainly because of that image, right? Because because of that gender fluidity, that the way she embraced the kind of less feminine aspects of her appearance. Rather necessarily than, you know, a great engagement with the art itself.
Maybe they just couldn't get any of it as well. Where is it all? Maybe it's in private collections because it was sold off really cheaply over the years because no one valued it at the time.
But also, I mean,
Madonna's got it all.
She probably has got a lot of it, hasn't she? But also, it's kind of interchangeable, isn't it? Because the art is all of her image anyway.
Exactly.
So it's kind of, you know, you could send your self round and round in circles on this. You know, it kind of, I'm sure the exhibition would say it interrogates the idea of the Freedolatry, but then when you get to the museum shop, you know, it is there in full force, isn't it?
What were your favourite things in the shop?
Well, you've got, I mean, the curtains were pretty amazing, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Full on Frida curtains.
In a kind of jungle scene.
Yeah.
Like, where's Wally, but where's Frida, standing behind trees? I like the hot sauce.
And refried beans.
And there was like a sort of Mexican cactus wall hanging as well for £50. Made of felt.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of people, you know, trying on sort of parrot earrings and, you know.
Is this too much? Am I mad? People trying on
super colourful clothing that they're never going to wear once they get up.
It is too much. No, you'll never wear it. Yeah, you make the point that it's like shopping on holiday.
I'll wear this. No, I will. I'm not. It's like you get out onto exhibition row and you're like, oh my God, what have I done? but it works, doesn't it?
It does work, I think. And it's well worth a visit.
If you know what you're getting in for, if you know you're getting in there to see prosthetic limbs, then go.
Frida Kahlo, Making Herself Up, is at the V&A until the 4th of November.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So quite a few British people, I'm presuming, unless I'm the only one who it's taken this long to catch up with it, I'm sort of finally having to get to grips with the concept of Childish Gambino after last month, was it? The This Is America video, which you don't need me to tell you about. But I knew roughly that this thing, Childish Gambino, existed.
Did you not get annoyed by the name? I used to get emails in 2011 about this guy and I was like, oh, that's such a silly name. I'm not even going to open these emails. And I got him mixed up with Chili Gonzalez.
It didn't actively annoy me, but I certainly wasn't inspired to like seek out his stuff. I mean, I think it's a sort of joke name, isn't it?
He, a character, isn't it?
He got it. He came up with it via a online name generator based on Wu-Tang Clan language. So anyway, but he is the creation of Donald Glover, who did this little Saturday Night Live skit where he described himself as a triple threat because he's an actor, musician, and what's the third one?
Stand-up comic,
writer,
yeah, but he
director.
Wanted to be a
he's
wedding
everything.
Planner when he was a kid.
Did he?
Yeah, apparently, according to the New Yorker, he profiled him a little while back. But I thought that was interesting. Probably one of these people who's just too creative, going in too many different directions, doesn't know where to settle.
Yeah, he's had this sort of interesting career in that he started off writing for 30 Rock, and then he was in Community and had appeared in Girls as well, and then wrote his own show, Atlanta, which has had two seasons, but is just now being screened on the BBC.
It's a strange,
we've been watching it,
dreamlike, meandering comedy that he sort of agreed was, yes, it's the Black Seinfeld, he said.
I like the, I think it's quoted in that New Yorker piece as well, but I forget where the quote comes from. I think it's another show, but it's like, comedies don't have to be funny anymore. You just have to end after 30 minutes. That's
exactly.
It, bang, you're a comedy.
He doesn't necessarily want people to laugh as well, because it does have these extremely cutting, shocking moments of exposing racial behaviour, basic racist behaviour. So it's sort of, it jumps up and bites you. And at the same time, it's very dreamlike. I mean, I watched it backwards by accident. So the first episode I saw is actually the most recent. And I thought, okay, I get this. It's like David Simon, because they were in a club and it was all subtitled. You couldn't hear what anyone was saying over the music. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to let this wash over me. And then the next episode, which was the part 7 out of the new series, was a completely fictional TV channel with a sort of fake talk show on it and fake made up adverts. And I thought, okay, I don't know what's going on. But then I did start at the beginning and now I get it.
This is the first season that we've been watching, we should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you say David Simon, because he said he loves it, and he said basically it's like a kind of compilation of all the bits that he really loved out of The Wire. So the things that aren't the things that aren't the main story, but like the kind of weird stuff going on at the side. And I should probably just the basic, I mean, there's not one of the striking things about it is there's no plot really, but it's basically this Donald Glover, as well as writing it, plays the main character, who's Earn, who's a sort of vacuum of a character, really. He's a Princeton dropout, and he's sort of homeless, but he's got a kid. He's got an on-off relationship with the mother of the kid. They're living together at the moment, where we are anyway. And they're in Atlanta, and then the other main character is his cousin who is a rapper called Paperboy, who's sort of experiencing the first bits of success. And it just sort of, it's kind of plotless. It just sort of meanders along. But you're right about that kind of sudden tonal changes, which is actually one of the, it's kind of the thing that's so amazing in a very concentrated way in This Is America. It's that kind of jarring tonal clash that makes that video so incredible. And like the second episode of, did you watch number two?
Where they're
in the they're not in jail, are they? They're in the waiting room.
They're basically in the waiting room of jail,
And it's quite funny. There's a bunch of it's like a kind of almost like a Beckett, you know, Waiting for Godot star humor. He's just sitting there. This couple have a conversation with him in the middle and he can't get out of it. But it's not just a couple having a conversation. It's a couple where the man doesn't realize that the woman is actually trans.
And they've already had a relationship.
And then there's like a kind of crazy guy who's like drinking water from the toilet. There's all this sort of insane stuff going on. And then suddenly it becomes really chilling. And there's an episode of sort of police brutality that's just completely shocking.
There's also, I think it might be in the same episode, an instance where a white mate of his, I don't know if it's a DJ or something like that, uses the N-word.
Yes, that's...
recounts a story in which he tells a black DJ, says that to him in a kind of affectionate, jokey way, as they all do within the programme. And it just shows the subtlety of that, the chill on Ern's face, and he gets him to try and repeat it later. Like, did you actually say that? Can you believe you said that? And so the sort of sense of the of those moments of racism that punctuate their lives it sort of underpins the entire thing, doesn't it? It's like, I also thought this extremely bizarre episode, which was I mentioned briefly before, number seven, which is the one in which Paperboy appears on a daytime TV discussion about a man, a black guy from Atlanta called Antoine, who is racially transitioning to a 35-year-old white man from Colorado. And he basically goes around, he says, well, how are you sort of beginning your transition? And he goes around wearing Patagonia clothing and asking, what kind of IPA do you have on tap? And it's a very sort of sharp look at the trans issues from the perspective of this kind of racial transitioning. Very, very odd. Extremely funny, slightly kind of old fashioned, I thought, as in terms of its humour. It was Brass Eye-ish to us.
Well, exactly. You're absolutely right. But what's striking is that it's kind of, people don't feel bold enough to do that now, really. It does feel quite edgy, I think, now.
The sexual politics spokesperson they have on there says to Paperboy, I think that I've done some research on your lyrics and they're very sexual spectrum too.
Yes. And then the presenter's just going, why do you hate trans people? Why do you hate women? And actually, but even in there, they managed to get in. There's a moment where Paperboy says something about like, why do you expect me to care about this issue when nobody cares about me as a young black man? And like suddenly in the middle of it, you've got a kind of very hard hitting point that kind of strikes home.
And in fact, this psychologist woman goes like, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. You're right. Also in that, I know it's absolutely tedious to just recount episodes, but just to give you a sense of, and again, like Brass Eye, although it's kind of slow and meranding, it's very dense in its humour in a way, especially that episode, because it includes all these sort of fake TV ads. And there's one that I just thought was absolutely inspired, which is a cartoon for Coconut Crunchos, children's cereal. And it starts off with this wolf chasing these kids to try and get the Coconut Crunchos. And then it comes to the sort of natural endpoint of the ad. And then like a policeman appears in the sort of Scooby-Doo style animation, and starts trying to arrest the wolf. And then it just turns into a sort of proper chilling kind of police brutality again. It's really...
This is why he said he doesn't want people to necessarily laugh at it, because, he's sort of saying, I don't want black people smoking weed because it's cool. I want them smoking weed because they've got PTSD.
Yeah.
Like that's what that's what the truth of this city is. And it is, it's a very, very strange city. I spent a couple of days there a few years ago, and it's one of the most sprawling and vast American cities I've been to. And you've got the sort of classic thing of the central business district also being the place where there's the highest homeless population. So the place that's creating the money is also the people with the least of it, who are sort of literally sitting in the doorsteps. And then you've got these kind of weatherboard houses that stretch right the way up to the airport, like quite beautiful old houses, but rickety. And then right in the middle, I think this comes up in the show as well, the Coke Museum, which is what everyone heads to Atlanta for. Or if you are there on business, as a lot of people are, then they'll obviously go to the Coke Museum. And I think they talk about that. But
is it the birthplace of Coke?
I think possibly, yeah. Right. Or maybe it's not even. Right. That would be so American, yeah. Right? And then there's some very rich villas with performing arts centres that are just around the corner from projects, right, and stuff. And I think he describes it as the Wild West. And he also has this point of making a location change in every episode, so you do get that sense of the sort of the drift of this this place and the how difficult it is really to just make it there in any way.
Well, I'm really hooked on this. It's I don't know how many episodes are in the season, but season one, all of it so far is on BBC iPlayer. The second season just finished. In fact, he's become this sort of media multimedia orchestrator, because in the States last month, it was the season finale of Atlanta, which is a really big deal in the States, right? This show is huge for FX, the channel that's got it.
It's their biggest ever thing, isn't
it? Yeah, it was the season finale of that. He guest hosted Saturday Night Live, and This Is America was released into the world on the same evening, basically.
You can only go down from here.
Yeah, so it's kind of extraordinary. So yeah, I recommend checking it out. Kate, it's time for our non-anniversary. What have you got?
It is. So 1997, how many years ago is that? 21?
Yep.
21 years ago right now, the song that ruled the airways of the world was I'll Be Missing You by Puff Daddy, featuring Faith Evans. I almost feel we've talked about it before. And I think the only reason for that, it was such a 90s irritant to me that I feel it's always in my mind somehow. In the 90s, the power of like local radio growing up in Norfolk, and there were some songs that were just on every time you turned the button on. And yeah, another one was Lisa Loeb's Stay, I Missed You.
Yeah.
Similar name. Joan Osborne's What If God Was One of Us, and this as well. So those things that were kind of like sentimental and maudlin, and you associate with ring roads and traffic jams in the rain. And this was one. And of course it samples Barber's Adagio for Strings and the spiritual I'll Fly Away. And of course, Sting.
Yeah, The Police. And I guess it's remarkable for, you know, the level of sampling is, it sort of takes sampling to a new extreme, doesn't it?
It's a grandmother's axe of a song. There's no song.
I was trying to think of other examples where the sample is just basically, I mean, it's just a cover version. It's sort of just a cover version. And I was sort of thinking, well, what was the deal with Sting on this? And they recorded it without asking his permission, but then so just present I guess just presented it to him, and he did give permission. I was thinking, well, that's kind of amazing that he did that. And then I looked down on the Wikipedia entry and it says Sting has 100% of the publishing royalties. I was like, oh, okay, that'll be why then.
Can you imagine what a source of Sting's income this song is? It's incredible. It was of course a tribute to the notorious B.I.G. Wallace, who was killed on March the 9th that year. So actually it was quite rush released, as they say. They got this together. They pulled this tribute together in 2 months.
Faith Evans was his widow.
Ah, yes.
Biggie's widow. And
I still find it sickening though as a song.
It's what was quite interesting is watching it is quite sickening, but the video is quite an unwrap video. Like, it's the only rural set rap video that I can think of. Like, he's on a hill. Puff Daddy. Was he Puff Daddy at that point?
He was, yeah. He was still Puff Daddy.
Then he became P. Diddy.
Is he in Elysium or something like that?
I think, well, certainly towards the end, there's a bunch of kids dressed in white who run up to the top of the hill, who I presume that's, you know, either they're going to be sacrificed to appease the gods, or they're in some sort of heaven zone.
Does he have little blue tinted sunglasses on? I feel like he does in the video.
He's got tinted sunglasses. Whether they're blue, I'm not sure, but he's also, it looks very 90s. The color palette is weirdly 90s. And the cut of his suit. He's slightly oversized.
Boxy.
Yeah, slightly boxy suit. Like he's a sixth former who's just gone to, I don't know, what would it, where would you go? I want to say Timpson's, but that's the place where you get your keys.
Burton's?
Cut. Burton's maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, it's his first suit. Also, I wonder if the money was it a charity song? I don't know. It feels like it should, like now it would definitely go to charity, but it probably just went to Puff Daddy.
No, I
or to Faith.
Well, it all went to Sting, I think.
It went to Sting, of course.
But no, I think there's a line in it where he's like, and now I'm taking care of your family. So,
okay, so
maybe, who knows?
It's still clothing, his family, B.I.G.'s family.
So happy 21st non-anniversary to I'll Be Missing You. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Back Half. Do get in touch with us on Twitter at @NS_podcasts or me at @Tom_Gatti. And we have an email address, thebackhalfpodcast@gmail.com. We've been recorded by Caroline Crampton and edited by Caroline. And we're going to play you out with
the testicle tweaking tune.
Why have these become so testicle focused?
I just think that's what it feels like. I don't have any, but it's the impact, basically. It's the impact. It never wears off. Godspeed by Pistol Jazz.
Take it away.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.